Hi, this is Dr. Pedro Ramirez, Editor-in-Chief of the International Journal of Gynecological Cancer. And today I have the great pleasure of having our guest editors for the special issue of March 2024 so that we can go over some of these really interesting and exciting topics that are published in this special issue. We have four guest editors, Christina Fotopoulou from the Imperial College of London, Ann Gerda Eriksson in Norwegian Radium Hospital, Glauco Baiocchi at AC Camargo in Sao Paulo, Brazil, and Oliver Zivanovic at the Heidelberg University Hospital in Heidelberg, Germany. Thank you all so much for joining this podcast, and thank you for the amazing work that you have done as guest editors for this special issue.
Hi, Pedro. It's a great pleasure for me here to be with you. It's an honor to join this special issue. Thank you.
Fantastic. Thank you all so much. And I know that obviously there's a lot of topics to be covered, and I wanted to actually ask and start by discussing what do you find as the most exciting about this special issue? And I'll start with you, Ann Gerda.
Hi, Pedro. Great to be here. So glad we were able to do this issue. I feel that the most exciting part, you know, we're really as surgeons trying to fit into this novel area with personalized medicine and really just patient selection, figuring out which patients will benefit most from the most extensive procedures, and also where can we do less. And I'm very, very happy also in this issue that we were able to incorporate a lot of the looking at how the surgeons are, you know, how does this impact us, our quality of life, quite frankly, and longevity within this quite challenging field. So I'm excited to read all those great articles.
Fantastic. And Glauco, your thoughts?
Well, Pedro, surgery is still the cornerstone of treatment in gynecological oncology. And the special issue brings together important topics in our field with regards of the radical tailored surgical approaches and also out of the box topics such as surgery for lymphedema, uterine transposition, imaging, quality of life, and medical legal aspects. And all articles were written by well-known experts in each topic, and they kindly accepted the challenge. And we are very happy and excited to launch this special issue.
Excellent. Christina?
Thank you, Pedro. It's great to have been part of this team. Really enjoyed it. So I think the most important in this issue is that we all thought out of the box. We didn't just choose conventional, you know, how do you strip the diaphragm, how do you do an anastomosis, but we really try to think out of the box to see how we can put modern medicine within the modern era of massive advances in the systemic treatment, in imaging, and how we can combine everything for the best of our patients. And I very much hope that our readership will like that.
Great. And then we'll close up that introduction with Oliver, your thoughts on this special issue.
I agree with my co-authors. I'm so glad and honored to be part of this, to be able to read through the articles. I think the themes that were chosen are very interesting. I think that the authors are, you know, very leaders in our field, and I think they devoted time to give us a very good overview of some major issues and advances, and also open questions still. So I'm really happy to be part of this and discuss this further with you.
Great. So thank you all once again. Christina, I'll turn to you for this one because obviously I think it's a very timely topic. There's an article by the group from Gemelli in Rome, and they speak about the windows of surgical opportunity in the era of targeted therapies. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, that was a topic that actually was very close to my heart, to all of us. And this is a topic that we addressed for the first time also in the ESCO perioperative guidelines that we issued a couple of years ago. So we increasingly more now, or actually almost all our patients that we operate are either after or before a targeted agent. Is it bevacizumab? Is it PARP? Is it AKI inhibitors? It's many, many things that we didn't know or we didn't use in the past. And now we are faced with the challenges of how this agents impact wound healing, impact recovery, and how much is the interval that needs to be left between surgery in order to safely operate. So the Gemelli team did a very, very good work in putting all that under perspective, giving really a very good overview and differentiate between anti-angiogenetic treatment, PARP inhibitors, and tyrosine kinase inhibitors. I hope that this will be very helpful to all of us, actually. Just because currently we as surgeons don't just operate anymore. We put our surgery in the package of care, in the package of everything, really. And we, yeah, that's what this update does.
And as a follow-up to that, I'll ask you, there's an article on implementing quality of life measures in surgical trials, which I thought was interesting. How do we go about doing that most effectively? And of course, obviously, we'll invite our audience to read each one of these articles in detail. But can you tell us a little bit more about quality of life in surgical trials?
Yes, so it would have been impossible to have an issue about surgical innovations without addressing the fact of quality of life. Quality of life is now something that is an integral part of any surgical trial. The German AGO started this with the Lion trial, with the desktop, with the trust, and all cervical cancer studies, endometrial cancer studies have now an integral part, which is the quality of life. We know now that it's not just survival that matters, but also how good the survival is. Our patients now live long, live years, just because we operate them better, we treat them better systemically. And it's of paramount importance that this long life is also good. So the team at the Charité in Berlin and also Dr. Oliveras from the UK, they're putting together a very nice article where they have given the most important overview of the most important articles of quality of life at surgical trials currently. They emphasize in the very good work from Sudha Sundara from the SOCA studies, which is a study that evaluated the quality of life really specifically after maximal effort surgery and compared it to the standard surgery, which has shown that actually there is no detrimental long-term impact of radical surgery on quality of life. On the contrary, the quality of life is actually better after surgery long-term than before. So that we turn down a myth that says that radicality of surgery, including stoma formation, including splenectomies, including all these things that perhaps put some people off, do not have a bad impact on the quality of life. And also the team presents some quality of life scores that, again, I hope will be helpful to the readers to use in their own setting.
Very well. I'm sure that was music to your ears, listening to how quality of life is not impacted by ultra-radical surgery. So I wanted to also ask you, there was an interesting article and an interesting topic and title, Medical, Legal, and Financial Aspects of Gynecology Surgery. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, so that was a topic that I think I wanted to put in, and I asked Paul Cohen and Rob Bristow. Increasingly more, we see that it's not just about survival, quality of life, technical skills. It's about defense mechanisms of the surgeons, infrastructure, financial problems. I mean, I have known and I've been very lucky to know three different healthcare systems. And even though these surgeons in all these three different healthcare systems, the UK, the Greece and Germany, actually have the same knowledge, they can implement this knowledge in a completely different way just because the setting is different. It starts from who is allowed to do the click in the rectal anastomosis till how much the surgeons get penalized because of high readmission rates, longer theater times that take up theater space. And then in the UK, we have problems with breaching times. So I thought it was very important to everybody that we put that into an article and show that people are not alone and people do not face those problems alone, but also give an incentive to the whole gynecology community that as these are our problems and we need to face them, and we can only solve them if we face them and if we discuss it with our managers and our governance and say, listen, if you want me to operate and do maximal effort surgery, I need beds for 10% readmission. I need a 5 Alfie at a time. Otherwise, it's not possible.
Excellent. Very well. So now I'll turn to Anne-Gert. Let's talk about reconstruction. And there was a really beautiful manuscript on reconstruction techniques. What should be the ideal reconstruction in patients undergoing gynecologic oncology surgery? Can you speak both about urinary reconstruction and flap reconstruction? And I know it's a long question and possibly even longer answer, but can you summarize for us that?
Absolutely, Pedro. Yeah, this is just for our readership as well, really. I mean, obviously read this entire issue, but in this article in particular, the authors have really gone to great lengths to explain both technically how to do the procedures, and they have some beautiful images and illustrations also so that the readers can really familiarize themselves with the different techniques. And so I think, you know, just by reading that, I'm not going to touch on the technique, but just as a caveat first, I think a couple of very important things that the authors point out is one, both excenerative procedures and then subsequent reconstructions is decreasing because we have new treatment modalities. And it's really, really important that these patients are seen by and treated by surgeons that are experienced, multidisciplinary teams and high volume centers. As really, this is a prerequisite, irrespective of which reconstruction technique the patient is selected for in the end. This is really needs to be in place first to take best care possible care of our patients. And then when it comes to the urinary reconstruction, again, there is, so there's the studies that I've done and meta-analysis, there isn't one best technique. We really need to individualize this and tailor it for the patients. We have incontinent urinary diversions. We have the continent pouches. We even have the orthoptopic bladder and the ladder, which is really rarely used for us because for most of our excenerative procedures, we need to remove the bladder neck and the urethra, which are needed for this procedure. But in regards to whether you should choose a incontinent or a continent pouch, really, we have to look at the patient. What is their age? What is their predicted oncological outcome? What's their dexterity? What are they willing to go through? Are they fine with having this extra stoma? Or are they actually, they don't want it, but they're then happy to do the self-catheterization, the irrigation? So really tailoring this and helping the patient make an informed decision in regards to what each reconstructive procedure entails, I think is most important here. And in regards to flaps as well, obviously we need to tailor that also to patient condition. What's the body mass of the patient? How much volume do we have to fill? Is there a minimal invasive or open procedure, right? In regards to, are we able to harvest from the abdomen, the rectus abdominis muscle, which is quite common to fill a large defect. But if you're doing MIS, you might have the incisions there. So you might want to take the donor site being from the thigh instead. Also in regards to stacking the stomas, you know, having one on the left and one on the right side, or does it have a body habitus where we can stack them one above the other? So I think just really tailoring it is very, very important. And then just as a baseline, you've kind of, as a prerequisite, the teams need to have the technical skills and the support system also in the postoperative period to support these patients through a procedure that has a very high mortality and morbidity associated with it.
Very well. So now we'll turn over to Brazil, Glauco. One of the latest surgical innovations in gynecologic cancer is the work by our friend Reitan Ribeiro on uterine transposition. What are some of the updates that we learned during this special issue and the developing of that manuscript on this procedure?
So, Pedro, all we know that in 2017, Reitan presented in the SGO and further published the first uterine transposition for a woman with a rectal cancer that underwent pelvic radiation for her primary cancer treatment. So further, the indications were expanded all over the world for other tumors that required pelvic radiation, such as sarcomas and also cervical and vaginal cancers. In last October, Reitan published in the International Journal the feasibility study on 8 cases of rectal cancer. And importantly, 2 patients attempted conception and had spontaneous pregnancies and live birth. In the present review that will be published in the special issue, Rayton colleagues reported 18 cases of uterine transposition that have been published in literature and highlights its feasibility and probably safety that offers a fertility-spiral procedure to preserve the gonadal and the uterine functions for those patients undergoing pelvic radiation. That's really, really brilliant.
Yes, and thank you as well for the contributions you're making in that field. Turning back to Angerda, of course, obviously on a special issue about surgical innovation and updates, there has to be an article about indocyanine in green, ICG, and near-infrared technology. What's new in this area?
Yeah, many of our colleagues are very well familiar with cervical injection, right, and sentinel lymph nodes and endometrial and cervical cancer. But there most certainly are other uses for this technique and this substance. And in this article, the authors really touch on, in regards to sentinel lymph node, the advances in vulvar cancer. We know, you know, from the groins and the GOG-173 trial that sentinel lymph nodes is really appropriate for select patients here, but the standard of care has been the dual tracer with the radiocolloid and the blue dye, but they have their disadvantages with being painful, needing the extra scintigraphy, the Geiger counter in the OR. And also the blue nodes, they're not that very easily visible. And we can see now there's more and more reports coming out that ICG is superior for detection. It's easier, it's feasible. I think we'll be seeing more and more of that utilized for vulvar cancer as well. And there's some nice images in this issue. Christina was touching on the medical legal aspects, and obviously we've all vowed to first do no harm. In this paper, they touched on visualization of the ureters. And as gynecologists, you know, we can very, very often visualize them, but certain patients, they've had radiotherapy, they might have challenging anatomical conditions, and the authors really nicely describe this retrograde installation of ICG to visualize ureters in these challenging cases. Very feasible, very safe for the patients, and to reduce injury in challenging cases. I'd also like to mention that in the journal, the International Journal, there's a surgical video on this technique that's under consideration or will be published very, very soon. So I think that will be great for our readership as well to just touch on that video to learn more. And then last but not least, in regards to perfusion and vascularization of flaps, the authors touch on this. It seems, you know, that use of ICG and near infrared light is really adopted and well accepted in reconstruction of breast. Whereas for gynecological reconstruction, we haven't really adapted it that much yet. But we really should. The reason that it's well adopted in breast is that ICG outperforms clinical judgment, both in regards to predicting necrosis postoperatively and failures of the flaps. And so the team at MSK actually very recently published from their prospective forefront trial, where they looked at patients with pedicle flaps after pelvic exonerations for GYN malignancies. And they showed that in more than 50% of the cases, the near-infrared light and the angiography there changed management intraoperatively of these patients. So I think we'll be seeing more of this for our patients also moving forward, hopefully.
Great. Thank you so much for that. Oliver, we'll turn to you. We'll start with the discussion of a complication that certainly is sometimes viewed as one of the worst complications for any patient in gynecologic oncology surgery, and that's the development of chronic lymphedema. Fortunately, it's not very common, and particularly after the implementation of sentinel lymph node mappings. But certainly when it happens, how should we tackle this?
Yeah, thank you, Pedro. Yeah, in this issue, the authors really did a great job in summarizing the literature, and they really looked at the advances that we had in reconstructive microsurgery and also the use of ICG as well, which is really important, and it really brings together this whole special edition. And you know, there are some advances such as lymphovenous anastomosis or vascularized lymph node transfer that they go over, and I think these are really important tools to have and to explore. And it's very important to build a good interdisciplinary team and also involve the plastic surgeons, because more often than not, the plastic surgeon colleagues are the ones who are really the experts. But these new techniques will allow us to hopefully tackle some of those bad complications. And I think this review is really very well written. Of course, we do not have randomized trials. So mostly this is retrospective trials and observational studies with all its pros and cons. But there's no doubt in my mind that these techniques will come and help shape the future of our patients. And I myself, I'm collaborating now with the plastic surgeon and trying to incorporate some of those techniques. There's so many questions. When should we do it? Can we do it prophylactically before radiation, or should we wait until the lymphedema is there? So there's so many open questions still, but all in all, this is a great article on a new avenue that is coming. So very happy to be able to review this.
Excellent. And another article that I saw that I haven't seen on this topic in a while is surgical management of gestational trophoblastic disease. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, and again, this is one of those diseases that we don't encounter very often. And this is a great article that summarizes the role of surgery that also in this age should be limited, because we have very good systemic treatments, and with a multidisciplinary team, those patients often can be cured, and the authors point this out. But there is a role for surgery in chemo-resistant disease sites, and they really go deep into the review of the literature here as well. No prospective trials, but observational retrospective studies. But it was really interesting for me to see that you can also sometimes locally excise chemo-resistant disease from the uterus with using a hysterotomy instead of a hysterectomy. Obviously, a hysterectomy is also sometimes necessary. And here also the authors mentioned the advances and the possibility of minimally invasive surgery, and obviously the DNC, not to be forgotten as well. So this is a great article on a rare disease, and it requires a multidisciplinary team. And certainly those techniques should be known and used, and it's great to have it written black and white.
Yeah, I'm sure it's going to be a point of reference article for many of us. Now, Oliver, I wanted to ask you perhaps one of the hottest topics in gynecologic oncology today, conservative management of cervical cancer, particularly with the landmark trial of the SHAPE being published now in the New England Journal of Medicine. Where are we on the standard of care with conservative management of early low-risk cervical cancer?
Oh, thank you, Pedro. After escalating surgery from minimally invasive to open, now we're de-escalating the radicality from radical to simple hysterectomy. And I was really very happy to review this article that's been written by amazing people and friends. And I think it is clear, and also hopefully with the publication of SHAPE, that there is going to be a change in the standard of care that we can offer patients with low risk early stage disease, small tumors, limited stromal invasion, a less radical form of hysterectomy. I did point out that I think this article, which is a great review article of three randomized trials and one larger observational study, I think that and I think that the publication of SHAPE is going to result in more questions and practicability too. Should we incorporate now more large conizations and do the sentinel lymph nodes at that time, wait for the final before making the decision? How do we discuss this with our pathologist when they give us the reports back? How can we use the MRI so that we really target the right patients? So there's lots of questions, but I hope that you're going to do another podcast with the experts here, and I'll be watching it from many times.
Excellent. So I'll turn over to Angerda for this question, although I would not be surprised if Christina jumps in as well. The question is, noted the article about extra abdominal saddle reduction. In an era where we are seeing an increasing use of neoadjuvant chemotherapy, is there a place for this type of surgery, extra abdominal saddle reduction?
So the simple answer to that question is yes. We could leave it at that, but I think we should owe it to the authors to elaborate slightly more. So in this review, the authors have done a good job, and they've chosen to focus on extra-abdominal disease in the thoracic cavity, so the cardiophrenic lymph nodes, supraclavicular, but also lung parenchymal and pleural lesions, and then also looking at mediastinal disease, and then the other extra-abdominal site being the groins, so inguinal lymph nodes. I guess in regards to the inguinal lymph nodes, there's definitely data out there that patients who have inguinal lymph nodes compared to other stage four disease really have better outcomes, and that it really is important to resect these lymph nodes. And I think also what we've learned as we're expanding our surgical armamentarium is that disease outside the abdominal cavity most certainly isn't a contraindication to surgery. It doesn't mean that these patients shouldn't undergo surgery. Complete gross resection is our goal. Whether you do neoadjuvant chemotherapy or not, these nodes or this disease needs to be removed. We've shown there's no randomized controlled trials, you know, on these disease sites, but the data that we have shows that it's feasible. It doesn't add a lot of morbidity to the procedure. And I think what was also very nicely pointed out in this article was the newly revised algorithm for VATS. So video-assisted thoracoscopy. At MSK, which is, you know, the two of the authors are from that institution, and Dennis Chi has really spearheaded this for many, many years, and shows that when you do VATS for patients with moderate to large pleural effusions, patients who do not have pleural disease can absolutely go for primary cytoreductive surgery. Whereas if they do have disease, they should only go for a primary cytoreductive surgery if you're able to resect all the pleural disease and also the intra-abdominal disease. And this is really important when we do triage our patients and decide who should have which therapy. And it's still an open question. We're working at it. I think as surgeons, it's really, really important to us, as I mentioned initially, is triage, right? Which patients will benefit most from the different approaches? And that's going to be our challenge in the years to come.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Angerda. So Glauco, I wanted to ask you, so there was a really wonderful article on the use of ultrasound in several disease sites in gynecologic oncology. What do we have to update there?
So Dr. Fisquero Vora and colleagues did a very comprehensive review, and they updated the European joint consensus with regards of the role of ultrasound in staging GYN gynecological cancer. It's a really an impressive work. They highlighted that the use of ultrasound has increased not only in diagnosis, but also for local regional staging for all types of GYN malignancies. They also included amazing videos for exemplification. And ultrasound has a great potential, is reliable modality, widely available, non-invasive, low cost, and without contraindication for the patients or any patient risks. So they suggest that based on the recent evidence, an expert ultrasound is recommended in equal alternative to MRI for local regional staging in vulvar cancer, vaginal cancer, cervical cancer, endometrial cancer. And it's the first choice to evaluate abnormal uterine bleeding and ovarian tumor characterization. And in experienced hands, it seems to be not inferior that CAT scan MRI in abdominal staging of ovarian carcinoma too. So the authors state that financial and logistical resources should be allocated for training for the future ultrasound experts in GI oncology. It's a very interesting and impressive work that I invite all the readers to go deep in this review.
And then now, Glauco, lastly, I wanted to ask, there was an interesting article on physical and psychological issues in the operating room. What does that mean?
Well, that's one of the out-of-box topics that was brought to attention in this special issue. The impact of surgery on surgeons' well-being encompasses both physical and psychological aspects. Physically, the surgeons are at risk to work-related musculoskeletal symptoms due to nature of our work. Additionally, the surgery can place a significant cognitive workload for the surgeons, and this can be exacerbated or alleviated by the surgical environment, experience of the assistance, surgical modality, and also by the case complexity. And addressing the impact of surgery on the surgeon is a huge challenge, and long-term positive change can only be sustained with the support of the whole surgical team and the healthcare organizations by developing and maintaining a supportive working environment. That's a very interesting out-of-box topic.
Really great. And again, I mean, I wish we could continue speaking about the details of these topics, but obviously I want to be respectful of your time. And of course, Dr. Fatopoulos has to go back to the operating room for her routine cytoreductive surgery. But I wanted to just kind
no,
of...
No, I finished. I did it between my answers and Anna Gerda's answers. It's fine.
Fantastic. Well, I just wanted to also, of course, obviously, in addition to thanking you, just hear from you as closing remarks as to what are your hopes with regards to what the impact that this special issue will have? And again, I mean, thank you all for the amazing job that you did. So, Christina, I'll start with you.
Thank you. First of all, again, thank you to the whole editors and office team of International Making of Cancer to make it such a nice journey for us. We really enjoyed it. And thank you, Emily and Pedro and Arthur for that. So again, because we thought out of the box and because we address so many topics that not only apply to surgery, but how surgery is being placed within these modern times, I hope and I think that our readers will learn a lot, will find the opportunity to reflect themselves in those articles and say, oh, I also have those problems. Oh, I also had these questions. And finally, these are being addressed. This is my hope, our hope. And that's why we invite you all to read it.
Great. Thank you, Christina. And Gerda?
Yeah, you know, it's been such a privilege to work on this issue and learn from this editorial group, but also from this authors. I feel it's really not just a privilege to us, but for the readers to have so many experts on these topics all collected in one issue. It's like a booklet that you can look up. You don't really have to search a lot, but just, you know, this one special issue is so educational and informative and also raises questions on so many levels for our colleagues. So I hope it will be a great resource, both for experienced surgeons and also people in training.
Thank you, Ingerda. Glauco.
Well, Pedro, I'm so honored and happy, grateful to join this team for the editors of the special issue. I'm very happy for this. Thank you so much for the invitation here in the podcast too. And it will be certainly a great source for knowledge in surgery, in GI oncology. And the special issue might help surgeons to deliver the best and adequate treatment for their patients. It will be a unique opportunity for clinicians, residents, fellows to enhance their knowledge on those important topics in surgery. Thank you, Pedro.
Thank you so much, Glauco. And we'll close with Oliver.
Yeah, I do. Pedro, I thank you, you know, for putting this team together. I do have to give a shout out to Christina, Anna Gerda, yeah, and Glauco, who really have done an amazing job and also pushed me a little bit because I was not always on time. So I apologize by ways of this podcast. But I think this is a great idea to also highlight surgery. I know that systemic treatments, molecular, personalized medicine is so important for our patients, but surgery remains important and even more important because we will be able to de-escalate where we can de-escalate, escalate where we have to escalate, and not do things where we don't have to do things. So I think it's really important. This special issue is great. I think it opens up new questions, hopefully for more podcasts with the experts and you. And I'm very grateful to be part of this. So thanks.
Thank you so much, Oliver. And, I should also say to our listeners that, this is a long journey in putting together a special issue. It started, approximately 12 months ago. So I do thank you of your time and the dedication you put in and all the endless correspondences that we had as it pertains to the special issue. But we're incredibly proud that you have all accepted our invitation and now seeing the end product, we're so pleased to see that this is a really excellent contribution to gynecologic oncology. So thank you all so much for participating and for accepting our invitation.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks.